Most of my professional career has been in international research. It's been looking at industry, regulatory environments, new entrants, public policies that affect mainly businesses in such companies as American Express, Yankee Group Research, and a university called CESA. My nonprofit organization does not make policy. It researches policies and in particular takes an industry approach to seeing which players have the greatest impact on U.S. Middle East policy, their histories, their activities, sometimes legal, sometimes not. Secret agreements, challenges between these organizations and law enforcement, and more important, what kind of actions can be taken to either reform or, in some cases, stop some extremely harmful activities. The output in terms of books have ranged from looking at the neoconservative Clean Break Plan in a book called Neocon Middle East Policy, looking at the impact of visa denial on education, on services trade, looking at some of the impact of trade agreements, in particular illicit activities that contributed to bad trade agreements between the United States and the region. And I think the challenge of being able to understand how we came to the current state of affairs where a number of organizations dominate U.S. policy formulation in the region is extremely important. Many of these organizations have repeatedly been challenged on their IRS tax-exempt status for Foreign Agent Registration Act violations. And it's important to understand, I think, exactly what people who want positive change are up against. And you can do that by taking a quick review of the situation and environment since World War II. This knowledge, I think, is extremely important if you're going to spread the word and take proactive action to change those policies. And what we'll be talking about tomorrow, for those of you who stay on, will be some case studies of real actions that have been taken to realize those changes. I use the word peristatal quite a bit when I talk about some of the largest lobbying organizations that have an overwhelming impact on U.S. policy. Some organizations that you may have heard of, such as the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, can trace their leadership back to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and international organizations such as the World Zionist Organization and Jewish Agency, which are basically the two fundamental organizations within the plan for a Jewish state in Palestine. The ongoing close coordination of these organizations in the United States and abroad is part of a little-known history that I've written exclusively about, or extensively about, not exclusively, in terms of how we came to have such a large unofficial policymaking impact in the United States. Figures such as David Ben-Gurion, when he first visited the United States, was executive director of the Jewish Agency, really a government in waiting, and among the first things he did were organize powerful business people to begin sending arms illegally to Palestine. Abraham Feinberg, probably one of the best and biggest cash bundlers and campaign bundlers from LBJ to the Johnson administration, from Truman to the LBJ administration, was famous for providing the type of support that could win a campaign or break a politician. And so I think understanding the impact that some of these international ties have had on U.S. policymaking is primordial. And what I'd like to talk about for the first few minutes is the bad news. The bad news about how we came to a position today where U.S. presidents can't even open certain areas for debates because of decisions made in the past. One of the most influential policymakers in the United States was Rudolf Sonnenborn, who met with David Ben-Gurion on a fateful day in July 1945 and began an archipelago of smuggling fronts across the United States under the auspices of being charitable relief organizations for displaced persons after World War II. But it wasn't about that. It was about gathering ammunition, tanks, guns, putting together blockade running ships, and a host of organizations either designed to look like businesses or nonprofits, but which were in the business of shipping guns and explosives purchased for pennies on the dollar to be shipped overseas to fight for independence. One of the most interesting was certainly Palestine Vocational Service, which stole the entire chaplain's list from World War II to begin combing through it to see if Jewish volunteers could be found to fight in Palestine for the upcoming War of Independence. The FBI became interested in some of these organizations when it found boxes of explosives falling onto New York piers in crates labeled as machinery or clothing, creating a danger, obviously, for the dock workers, but also allowing them to trace back many of the front companies to the peristatal organizations, the Jewish Agency, the World Zionist Organization, and serious investigations were made into why they were violating the Arms Export Control Act, why they were violating the Neutrality Act, why they were undermining U.S. foreign policy. But of course, none of this ever led to anything. There were only, in the history of prosecutions of very small people who were ever arrested and indicted. One of the reasons for that was super lobbyists and extremely active organizations who were able to swarm the Justice Department and put together a war chest of money to influence various politicians that prosecuting would be a bad idea. In an FBI file declassified in 2010 about super lobbyist Abraham Feinberg, this idea of the war chest and disbursement of funds to quash prosecutions was key. So, although many were involved in this amateur foreign policy, which was not sanctioned by the United States, very few were ever prosecuted. And the organizations and systems that they created are still with us today in many circumstances, sometimes hidden, sometimes not. One of the most interesting in the subject of my last book, which is called Divert, traces the activities of some of these smugglers after they left the conventional smuggling business. And this has been the subject of many overseas press reports as new documents continue to come out of such clandestine organizations as the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, the Carter Administration Library, and that is nuclear smuggling, and we'll get to that in a minute. Now, were people angry about the conventional weapons diversions? Yes. There was a tell-all, boastful book about it that came out in the early 70s, and it immediately triggered responses from such disgruntled lawyers as Norman Dacey, who insisted that there be prosecutions and told the Justice Department that they had to uphold the law for all or pack their bags and leave. But he was rebuffed by the State Department, by the Justice Department, who let him go and figure out if, by privately funding legally research, if any of the laws were even prosecutable now that the statute of limitations had run out. He also cited ongoing violations of a Disclosure Act designed to protect Americans called the 1938 Foreign Agents Registration Act, which says if you're bringing in money, if you're bringing in political influence to try and influence the thinking of Americans, you need to disclose that in a public office. But these laws never applied to any of the largest lobbying organizations as they carved out their state in Palestine. In fact, one of the biggest at the time, 300,000 members, the world's the Zionist Organization of America, actually was ordered to register as a foreign agent 7 times, according to documents released last year by the Justice Department. But they finally, according to the career attorneys, got to the AG, the Attorney General, and convinced him not to prosecute. And he actually told them they need not fear prosecution either now or in the future, no matter what they were involved in. Well, imagine the license that this gave some of these organizations. The Senate also investigated this type of lobbying, this type of tightly coordinated international lobbying, and specifically was citing the idea that if such things, such as foreign terrorist attacks, could be allowed to influence U.S. policymaking in the region, specifically citing a false flag Israeli attack on U.S. facilities in Egypt, if that's the way that policy was going to be formed in the United States, that we were certainly lost if we couldn't get a handle on this as a country. And so the Senate Foreign Relations Committee investigated foreign agents focusing heavily on peristatal lobbying organizations between Israel and the United States in particular. They raided offices of these large organizations, seized documents. And what did they find out? Well, they didn't find out too much. They asked the IRS, in some cases, why these organizations even had charitable status. They asked them if they could comment on the activities, in particular smuggling, and they never got any answers. One of the organizations that they ordered to register as a foreign agent in the early 60s simply packed its bags, folded it up, and reemerged 6 weeks later as the organization some of you may know today called the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. The organizations were brilliant at reshuffling their corporate charters even after foreign agent registration orders, this one signed by Robert F. Kennedy, and reemerging. And once again, imagine the power of large lobbying organizations that could, whenever they were caught doing something that severely impacted policy formulation in the region, could simply get off on an excuse. And here are some of the big excuses. When some smuggling organizations connected to the ZOA were caught, they formed a task force, met with the FBI director and said, you know what, we're not involved in anything that's going to hurt the United States. This was Robert Nathan, who was a war economics planner before being tasked to do this. He said, we're not doing anything damaging to the U.S., but some prominent people and organizations might be hurt if you ever try and crack down on us. In the 1938-1960s, these 7 orders to register, the ZOA simply said, well, we're not receiving foreign funding. We might be receiving foreign control, but you can't prosecute us for that. And on and on. Diplomatic immunity for espionage charges that occurred in the mid-80s. What is it? What is it that allows many of these organizations to flaunt any sort of oversight? Well, we're going to take a look at that. Here are some 4 different large areas, though, of activities and violations that have relatively little to do with Palestinian concerns, but which are growing in terms of American concerns over this sort of activity as a corruption issue as opposed to a Middle East politics issue. And the first one is certainly the most interesting. In the 1940s, it was all about conventional weapons smuggling. It was all about shipping the implements of war to Palestine to arm a first-class army that could defend this newly created state. By the 1950s, it was all about nuclear materials. Apollo Industries was a $4,000 nuclear fuel reprocessing plant that was formed in Pennsylvania with two Zionist Organization of America executives and one future ADL chair, along with a man with close connections to Israeli intelligence. This single company, over the course of its activities, managed to lose more weapons-grade uranium than any other U.S. processing facility. This is the stuff that you make nuclear weapons out of. It was visited by some of the most famous spies, including Raphael Eitan, who ran Jonathan Pollard against the United States in the 1980s. FBI testimony that emerged in the 1980s also verified executives of the company loading canisters of HEU, not into crates and labeling them as machinery, but into irradiators, which were supposedly being shipped overseas empty, so that people could study radiation in the SOREC facility. As I mentioned, this single facility, according to a 2001 audit, lost almost twice as much weapons-grade uranium as any other fuel reprocessing organization in the United States. The material unaccounted for while some of these executives associated with the ZOA were in charge, 2% of everything that went through the door. When they left, it fell to industry norms. During the time of the buildup of this foreign arsenal, which the U.S., by the way, does not acknowledge, can't acknowledge, organizations such as the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, in their newsletter, were putting out cover information saying, this country is too small to ever have a nuclear weapons program. Surely if there are suspicions, they should not be directed toward us. This site is now undergoing a $500 million toxic cleanup, because with $4,000, you can't put in the types of safeguards you need to actually have a valid nuclear processing facility. It's an unofficial cancer cluster in which the citizens of this small community have been suing both the subsequent purchasers of the company and the U.S. government for compensation. Let's talk about some other things of vital concern when it comes to the lobbies that have the most influence in U.S. Middle East policy formulation. Michael Goland was an AIPAC director who illegally donated $120,000 to a candidate that forced votes to flow from a challenger, Edwin Zhao, to Alan Cranston, who won by the margin of the spoiler votes. Golan was indicted for conspiracy. He even spent some time in jail. But what did he win? He won for the lobby, the Cranston Amendment, in which U.S. foreign aid to Israel will never sink below the level of interest payments that have to be paid. He managed to get a lot more aid because he was prescient enough to see in 1984 that Iran was only 7 years away from having a nuclear weapons program. He was also leading the fight against trade and arms sales against Arab countries. So was the election fraud worth it? Was it worth shifting policy? The rise of stealth PACs also had a material influence. These political action committees that arose in the 1970s were ways for the lead lobbying organization, AIPAC, to optimize campaign contributions. When individual donors in this era could no longer max out, they could make donations to political action committees, many formed with starter kits passed out by AIPAC. These grew in number over the 1970s and 80s to become a major force in politics. It was completely and totally illegal to coordinate PAC donations to any candidate. But memos leaked to the Washington Post revealed that AIPAC was doing exactly that. Now, some disgruntled Americans fought this in court for 20 years, up to the level of the Supreme Court, and lost as election laws slowly changed underneath them. In the 1970s, in order to quash a missile sale to Jordan, AIPAC Director Morris Amite got his hand on missile secrets, used them to quash the deal, almost, according to the State Department, driving Jordan into the hands of the Soviets. It was, according to the State Department, a major impact on U.S. policy formulation. No prosecutions. Probably one of the biggest myths is that the American business community is behind every Middle East policy, whether it's from arms sales, decisions to go to war, free trade agreements. The free trade agreement, however, that was inked between the United States and Israel was anything but. 70 of the organizations that were lobbying on this issue, including Monsanto, said, if we're going to have a free trade agreement with some country, make it a significant, large country, and make sure that the benefits aren't only one way. The organizations lobbying for a free trade agreement in 1984 and 85 were mainly small organizations, many small traders in Israel. And what happened? In order to take a competitive advantage from the organizations that didn't want the free trade agreement, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and the Israeli Ministry of Economics managed to acquire the entire classified U.S. Trade Administration document about all of the reasons why these organizations, from pricing to market share to production costs, why they were lobbying against this and used it against them in public relations and lobbying. This act of what was investigated as theft of government property and espionage, was it worth it? Well, it turned a fairly even trading relationship of exports and imports into a $10 billion subsidy. It reversed basically a balanced trading relationship and created an imbalanced trading relationship. The equivalent of 120,000 jobs that weren't created in the United States, if you use some of the formulas for calculating that. So there was an impact. It was a negative impact. And finally, in 2005, there was a series of Espionage Act indictments because two AIPAC employees managed to get classified national defense information and tried to convince Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post that it signified that Iran was attacking the United States and Iraq. The judge made prosecution of this particular lobbying initiative very difficult by forcing prosecutors to consider state of mind and other one-time special cases that have never been repeated in courts, and the Obama administration quashed the prosecution. The FBI was furious about this, but I think by this time they're finally getting used to the fact that if they try to have any sort of accountability for this particular lobbying organization, it's not going to happen. But if you look at that instance, and this is, we're getting into the positive thing now. If you look at that instance of accountability, where there was at least an indictment for each of the executives involved, it represents kind of the first time a major propaganda campaign has been reversed positively for all Americans. Again, during the Levant affair, that was covered up for decades. The Israeli nuclear weapons program, still a secret in U.S. administrations. Other instances, such as a great deal of the debunked propaganda that was used to convince America to invade Iraq. But in this one case, the idea that Iran attacked the United States, it didn't work. Now, there's been, according to some of the seized documents from these 1960s investigation, a very skillful effort by parastatal lobbies to cultivate editors, to buy big print runs, to promote Judy Miller-type journalism, which means journalism that's mainly propaganda, and pitch ideas. In fact, some of the best policy magazines have been wholly owned subsidiaries of various lobbying organizations. But that's changing. And that's changing very, very quickly. The era of limited outlets that will not let Americans be more fully informed about what's really going on is coming to an end. And I think some people, according to polls, think that end isn't coming soon enough. About the time Americans were beginning to receive better reporting about the lack of evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, Americans who reported that they didn't have very much confidence in mainstream or mass media for reporting became the dominant view. It reversed until currently it's about 60%. If you look at public awareness of some of these corruption events that I'm mentioning, the time between the incident and broad public knowledge of what happened has been declining. For the 1940s arms smuggling, information about that didn't come out until decades later. For this most recent incident, however, the news is almost immediate. And a lot of that is due to alternative journalism and, frankly, new alternative news outlets. Some of the people who are now reporting about U.S. Middle East policy don't have a mainstream media background, but they have huge followings. They develop a following through Twitter, through various blogs, because they have a uniquely informed opinion and experience, they're beginning to reverse the dominance of major media. And you can see this with some harsh critics, such as Glenn Greenwald, who is one of the harshest critics of Middle East policy, one of the harshest analysts, having many more followers for his periodic broadcasts of information and ties to his news articles than a pundit such as Jeffrey Goldberg, who meets with presidents and prime ministers but is not that widely respected among more serious scholars. Core lobbying objectives today, I think, continue to be drivers of U.S. policy. It's not about guns and money. It's about coordinating the campaign finance system, suppressing debate in key areas, providing a cover for expansion, shaping policy, and minimizing its own role by claiming broad public support and diminishing the idea that there's an international connection. But the brand is failing. Increasing numbers of the public think the brand of a lot of the key policy organizations like AIPAC, like ZOA, is we're here to suborn your politicians, steal your taxes, and transfer out your revenues. That's not the image they want, obviously. The image they want of the last 3 points, that only U.S. and Israeli interests are the same, that it's the only democracy, and that it's almost always in danger. But people aren't buying it anymore. Why? According to a Chicago Council survey of American public opinion, which is representative of some 94% of households, they've learned enough not to want to take sides anymore. The number who want to take neither side is now well in excess of 60%, according to a poll of which side do you take in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Neither side. That's now the dominant view, and it's extremely tied to a shift in information availability. Another poll number from the Chicago Council Survey of American Public Opinion. Where should the United States be putting its foreign aid budget? The number of Americans who say that it should be increased, the amount of aid to Israel, is falling. It's fallen steadily since 2002. The number of Americans who think that it should be decreased or stopped altogether, 41%. And if you take the number of Americans who either want to keep it the same or decrease it, they're now in the majority, according to this poll. Almost 90% don't want to see this particular aid increased. But the interesting thing is, what impact is that having on policy? As you might have guessed, the trend of U.S. aid to Israel since the 1940s to the present day has been one way, and that's to give more aid every single year. So how long can this schism between public opinion and what's actually being done endure? And what's behind it? U.S. military aid to Israel in 2012 and 2013 will approach unprecedented levels, but it's coming at a cost. If you look at what's probably the key organization, the key non-governmental organization that measures perceptions of corruption, since the beginning of 2000, the United States standing has been going the wrong way. This is an index where you want to be the lowest on the public perception of corruption scale. You don't want the United States, in this case, to be increasing 2 and 3 steps. But that's what's happening. And I think it's legitimate to perhaps think that's linked to the schism between what's actually happening in public policy and what the American people are asking for. Here's one interesting example. The Jewish Agency, which was at the heart of a lot of this smuggling that took place back in the early 1940s, is still around. And not only that, it's instead of receiving donations, it's receiving your tax dollars. $25 billion a year since 1973 to 91, 2000 to 2013, $41 million a year. This organization has hosted and funded key pundits who have produced very little in the way of progress in Middle East negotiations, such as Dennis Ross, who is in charge of a Jewish Agency think tank. Its American section was shut down after questionable receipt of overseas funding and misappropriation. It was at the heart of the 60s investigation of propaganda funding in the United States. It's now lobbying for the release of Jonathan Pollard, Israel's top spy. In other words, American taxpayers are now funding for lobbying of themselves rather than have it simply be done privately. And so challenging this sort of behavior is not, as I mentioned before, a job for small numbers of interest groups. It's going to take a coalition effort. And there have been many failures in the past to deal with this sort of thing, such as just not much information, lack of coordination, no stamina, wrong leaders, wrong partners, people being under the assumption of good faith that they could simply take these issues, such as Norman Dacey, to the Justice Department and say, do something, and finding out that they're not going to do something. And so what we'll be doing tomorrow is looking at some case studies about bypassing media, spreading the word, building coalitions on the internet, and how self-interest will now drive a more positive outlook for Palestinian issues than a narrower approach. Because it's come down to that. Americans are also being victimized. And so I'm going to skip ahead. I'm just going to tantalize you with some of these case studies and skip ahead to the point. The point is overlapping concerns. If you think of how traditionally Palestinian issues have been framed, it's been about ongoing property and resource theft. It's been about being on the receiving end of warfare. It's been about constant propagandizing. If you look at concerned American issues, it's pretty much linked on a bigger scale. Endemic misuse of U.S. taxpayer funding, regulatory capture, where you can't get redress for grievances like we're supposed to, propaganda that clouds the vision of politicians and the public alike, secrecy, declining accountability. The overlapping concerns mean that there's a vast potential now for broadening the coalition of groups that's seeking a more just and reasonable regional policy. And that is not just about redress of grievances in the region. It's about respect for property rights, respect for sovereignty, not privatizing foreign policy, taxation and representation, not funding foreign lobbying, rule of law, transparency. The opponents, obviously, of transparency and good government have been, in this domain, Israel and some of its parastatal lobbying organizations. Not the only ones, but they've certainly been at the lead. And so, with that, I'd like to insist that those of you who want to find out about how to do online activism that gets results in building coalitions and in getting out the message, come to lunch tomorrow. With that.